Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Deal Maker Show. So today we have a really amazing guest. You know, a guest that again, you know, he's done it. You know, building, scaling, financing, and also partially exited too. We're going to be talking about secondary, you know, type of transactions. But again, you know, we're going to be talking about all the good stuff. I mean, in his case, also he's a climber, so we're going to be able to identify some similarities, you know, around sleeping, you know, in vertical type of environments for many days, and how you perhaps, you know, learn stuff around business, partnerships. Again, you know, he's built stuff in Latin America. So I think that it's definitely a different way of doing business, you know, compared to the US. But again, a lot to learn. So brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Matthew Kligerman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro. It's great to be here. Listen to your show a lot through my entrepreneurial journeys. And it's really nice to now be here with you.
Thank you so much, Matthew. So originally born in Florida. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
It was really nice growing up there. We grew up in a pretty normal upper middle class neighborhood and family. I had two great loving parents. Both of them have a lot of entrepreneurial spirit and definitely gave a lot of it to me. They were working professionals, but each had their own offices that they'd built up from scratch. And yeah, it's funny. A lot of my childhood in South Florida is peppered with door-to-door sales around the neighborhood that I lived in. You know, it's funny. I think a lot of my later on business lessons grew out of some of these crazy childhood businesses and sales. I would just go around selling, you know, for fundraisers, save the Amazon t-shirts, knocking on all the doors of the neighborhood. Or I remember my parents taking us to Costco to go buy big packs of muffins and drinks to sell on hot days at the swap shop, this flea market nearby, or rolling around toys in my little wagon and selling toys to kids around the neighborhood as a kid. And when I spent all my summers growing up in Asheville, North Carolina, my granddad built a summer camp there. And as a kid, spent all my summers there just playing around, having a blast, and then ended up working just many different jobs at that camp, from counselor to coordinating counselors to running a rock climbing program at the camp. And, you know, it's funny. And as a kid, I just loved the camp for what it was. And as I've grown older, I look back on that a lot and what my grandfather built and seeing, you know, 1,000 kids go through there every summer and all the memories that are formed for kids, the new experiences they have that push them outside their comfort zone. And more and more, I see this as a legacy that my grandfather built. He's passed now. A legacy he's built that's really inspired me for the companies that I've built to not just make money and be good businesses, but to have amazing impact for the people who are involved in them and create amazing experiences that help for their growth and create memories and journeys and friendships for each of them too.
So in your case, you know, you ended up getting into engineering. So that whole, obviously, you know, seeing, you know, your family, you know, doing business and what you experienced too, you know, I'm sure that that gave you kind of like, you know, some type of perspective or approach into problem solving, let's say in business, but I guess problem solving as a whole and then also engineering, what really sparked your interest to go in that direction?
Yeah, I'd say engineering. I studied mechanical engineering, and I'd say that's actually because I had this crazy physics professor in high school. He was this Cuban guy, Mr. Archiboleta. He was this Cuban guy who had studied nuclear physics in Cuba and had built a raft and sailed over to South Florida, got onto land, and soon thereafter became my high school physics professor. He was way overqualified to be our professor, and he was incredible. And I think, you know, just like discovering the mysteries of the universe and how things worked was incredible with him. And that definitely pushed me into engineering, as well as a general affinity for math and sciences. And then last, I'd say I've loved rock climbing ever since probably I was 16, I got into it. And there are certain devices in rock climbing that the physics of how they work to basically stick into the rock to support a falling climber is really interesting. They're actually really interesting engineering marvels, how they were built. And I was pretty obsessed with the engineering behind them. And so those factors all made me want to go dive into the engineering world and pick that coming out of high school.
So in your case, you know, obviously after Duke, you even in Duke, you know, you had the entrepreneurial, you know, kind of like bug, and you got started with Legacy Links. So what happened with Legacy Links?
Yeah. It's funny to think about Legacy Links. You know, I wouldn't even call it an entrepreneurial bug or a business at that point. You know, it was really just this crazy little side hustle. When I was at Duke, I was running the outdoors club there, and I was the president of the outdoors club, but I was also the webmaster of the outdoors club website. This is at a time when the term webmaster still existed, and I would just update HTML and stuff on the site. But one day I got an email from someone, some weird marketing company, asking me if I could put a link onto our website and that they would pay the club $10 per month if I put this link on the site. And I thought about that. I said, wow, 10 bucks a month. That's, to me, you know, 120 bucks a year for this link. That sounded like the jackpot. That was big money back then. It seemed great. We could buy a whole other climbing rope for the club. Amazing. Put the link on and kept adding more that this company would give me, and other companies started reaching out too, oddly enough. I think we had 20 links on the website. We were generating like 2,400 bucks a year. You know, for me, this was huge money. We could, you know, I think we bought a trip to Peru or financed part of the trip to Peru with a lot of this funds. But something didn't quite make sense to me about this. You know, why would these random companies like a LASIK eye surgeon in Colorado be wanting to advertise on the Duke Outdoors Club website? There's no traffic that's going to get to them from this. And I looked into it, into these companies, and found out they were search engine optimization companies. They were companies that were basically helping their clients get to the top of Google. And I researched more into this and found out that the way Google's algorithm worked, this is back in 2005, the way it was working was Google had built out this custom link graph algorithm to be able to understand how other websites and the internet are linking to one another. And essentially, when high-quality websites link to another website, that shows an authority into the graph for Google's link graph and helps that website receiving those high-quality links to rank higher. But then what was really interesting is I saw how much these SEO companies were charging their clients for those same links they were putting on my site. And I saw they were charging their clients 200 bucks a month. And, you know, all of a sudden, that $10 a month that seemed like, you know, the jackpot, I just couldn't, $200 a month just seemed, you know, totally surreal. So I reached back out to those SEO companies and asked them if they needed more links for their clients. And they told me they couldn't get enough. If I got them sites, they would fill them up with links. And we cut a deal to basically split it 50-50, more or less, I think, or I'd get 50 to 100 bucks per link. And I reached out to all my best friends who had just graduated from high school and then were at universities all over the states. And basically asked them to recruit websites at their universities for me. And I would pay each of them 10 bucks a month, each of the clubs that they recruited 10 bucks a month per link. I paid them not 10 bucks a month, I paid them $10 a month per link they got. And overnight, they all went after it, recruited a bunch of sites, and I built essentially the largest .edu marketplace in the world at that point in time. I didn't realize this was very black hat SEO. Black hat SEO is, you know, this is like the hacker side of SEO. This is not following by Google's rules at all. It's definitely cheating their algorithm. At the time it worked, I didn't realize that it was this black hat side of things, but it was really, really effective. And people paid good money to get a link on Stanford's website or Princeton's website. So that business actually started growing quite a bit through school. We probably had about 30 people or so working for the company part-time throughout the country. And that, although we started off with this, you know, at the time I didn't really know what to call it. Now I would call it more of a managed marketplace. And we ended up building on top of this because we saw how effective these links were to the sites that we would link to, we actually ended up building out our own agency to then provide SEO services to customers and provide much more of the services beyond just the link building side. And then we actually evolved that into building out our own lead generation web properties, where we would build our own web properties, would use the links to then drive those properties to the top of Google very quickly for valuable search terms, such as car insurance, get leads, and then sell those leads to others in the market. And this, you know, at the time, honestly, I kind of thought this was a fun little side hustle. Didn't really think much of it. It ended up teaching me a ton about digital marketing. It led a lot to what happened later on in my life.
So in your life, I mean, obviously, you ended up, you know, coming out of basically this experience, right? And instead of like keep going at it, you decide to go into corporate America. So how did that happen?
Yeah, I guess I didn't really see this business as even a real business back then, even though when I look back on it, it was actually a really lucrative, great business. I think I just felt it would be helpful. And honestly, I'm not sure if this was right, but at the time I thought it would be really helpful to go get a job in a real company to actually get real skills and learn. I didn't really consider what I was doing real skills back then for some reason. They were probably the most real ones though. So yeah, when I graduated Duke, I ended up going to, I was graduating in 2009, and basically it was like just after, you know, the 2008 market crash, probably the worst time to go into the job market. I really just would get any, you know, was happy with any job I could possibly get in the finance space in Wall Street. I ended up getting a job working for Citi with an amazing boss, and I actually got quite lucky. I joined a job. It was not one of those typical investment banking or a typical trading desk. I was actually on a product team building out services and technology for fund managers to use to better manage their investment funds and firms, which was actually really lucky. It was actually basically building a business with the bank. And so I did that. The business that I built in college, Legacy Links, I kept doing this as a side hustle. So I would be kind of, you know, be working at my desk, and then I have a client with an urgent request, and I would, you know, step into the bathroom to send some messages on my BlackBerry back then, or step to the corner of the office and like do a kind of hidden phone call with a customer. And that I was juggling these two things, and honestly, there was a lot of learnings from each one that helped the other. It was actually quite complementary, and eventually, Legacy Links, that business that I was running at the same time, we started actually breaking into the VC and PE world out of New York, actually. And we started working with the portfolio companies of a handful of VC and PE investors. We were doing really high quality work. We'd evolved a lot from that black hat strategy into more, you know, quality long-term strategies. And I really, honestly, that was one of the most helpful experiences for me, was working into that space, because for the first time, I got to see what incredible entrepreneurs looked like. I got to really, you know, go into meetings with them, pitch them. And I remember the first one I pitched on a project, you know, I got totally smacked down. You know, I just ate humble pie completely. Prior to that, I would go talk to customers and, you know, I would just wing it. And any deal, you know, I would generally close pretty effectively. This time I talked to an incredible entrepreneur who was asking me, where's the data? Where's the preparation that you have for my specific company on this? And it really upped my game. I learned, you know, to go into meetings with another level of data and preparedness to be able, and also just to know what excellence looked like in the world. It was really inspiring for me. And so that company I essentially kept running at the same time. I hired a manager to go run it while at Citi. Citi eventually asked me to go down to Brazil for a one-year project down there, and that ended up becoming a, you know, decade-long incredible journey.
Well, how do you go into entrepreneurship again? You know, how do you find yourself in Brazil and then also into the venture world again?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, at that point, I was getting ready to leave Citi. I you know, I had a great boss, but there was a lot I just felt like I wasn't really learning or growing or using all of my skills in the way I could, but I didn't know what I wanted to go build. Citi offered me this chance to go down for a year to build a business down in Brazil. And honestly, it just sounded like a great adventure. Like, who wouldn't want to go have a year down there, learn a new language, meet new people, have fun? So I went down there not expecting, only thinking it'd be a one-year journey. That was it. And I mean, first off, on a personal level, I completely fell in love with Brazil. I mean, more than anything, the people in that country are just incredible. You know, the most warm, welcoming, fun, loving people. It's really special, and had a great time in the year there personally. But also when I moved down there, you know, I had to set my life up completely. And I had to go through the buying process as a consumer in Brazil with all these different brands. I had to go get internet for my home. I had to go get a mobile plan for my phone. I had to go open up a bank account, get a credit card, get health insurance. And going through this experience as a consumer, I felt like I had been teleported back like 5 to 10 years from the comparison in the US. Very little was online. What was online was really inefficient acquisition flows. I think they would all take you to a call center once they generated a line where you'd wait on hold with an agent for 10 minutes, speak to someone you could barely understand over the phone, calls getting dropped, you know, terrible customer experience. And many of the times it wasn't even digital. It was still brick and mortar stores or people who would literally come to your house to come sell you a health insurance product with a giant 100-page book of plans that you would try to understand that they probably didn't even understand. And so going through that experience as a consumer there, it just made me hyper aware that brands in Brazil, these big brands, were spending billions of dollars in digital marketing and just wasting it. You know, it was just going down the drain with these inefficient conversion funnels and not being able to really, one, convert those customers effectively, and also create great experiences for customers interacting with their brands. And I got really excited to build something in that space. Didn't know what it would be at the time. And so quit my job at Citi. And I convinced one of my business partners, we have three business partners at Escali, three founders, myself, Ken Diamond, and a Brazilian, Daniel Rosa, who joined a little later in the story. I somehow convinced Ken, this guy who I kind of barely knew at the time, but we had a strong affinity for each other. And we'd been mentoring each other on each other's businesses at the time. Somehow I convinced this guy to come down to Brazil with a one-way flight. I got him an apartment next to mine, a cell phone chip, and a bank account in my name, and convinced him to come down to help to explore this business idea with me and what could we go build in this space. And we got really, we got really excited about we didn't know what we wanted to build, but we knew there was this big gap in the market around efficient customer acquisition for these brands. And so we started off actually building a bootstrapped digital agency down in Brazil. Not that we wanted that to be our long-term business by any means, but at that point, we barely understood Portuguese. We didn't know anyone to hire. We didn't know any clients to go talk to. We just felt like we had to understand the market a little bit better. And we felt building an agency would be a way to start building a A-plus team of digital marketing talent, train that team, understand the ecosystem better, and be ready to actually go in to go build whatever that vision would be for ourselves. As we did that for about 18 months, you know, bootstrapped that business, which was, you know, I mean, such a scrappy experience. As I look back to it, you know, it really feels like a Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel of this mix of fantasy, fiction, realism, all blended together. You know, I can barely tell what was what as I think back to those early scrappy days in Brazil. And eventually we moved into what became our long-term business model. From the agency business, we started helping brands beyond just the digital marketing side of things, of lead generation, and actually into full funnel conversion, where we would not just generate the leads, but we would actually convert those leads into sales for our customers. And in doing that, we actually perceived the biggest challenge that brands had was specifically in that conversion side. And then we went all in towards building out a conversion platform for brands in Brazil, for banks, for telcos, insurance carriers, to help them convert their customers more effectively. I can share more in a little bit, but this is, that became the real Escalia that we've now built.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So I guess for Escali, for the people that are listening, what ended up being the business model? How is the company making money?
Yeah. So basically, the product is, we built out a conversion platform to help brands convert their customers more effectively. That conversion platform is a combination of lead scoring when a lead comes in to the platform to decide the chance of that lead being able to convert, and a lead routing component to be able to decide what is the best channel to route that lead into. And then we will actually send that lead to our own, if it makes sense as part of the conversion routing, to our own sales conversion via chat. And that conversion via chat is now enabled with our AI sales agents to be able to convert those customers at a much lower cost and higher conversion rate. We do the customer onboarding, marketing re-engagement, and then we send the conversion data back to the marketing platforms of the brands for them to actually have accurate marketing ROI attribution. Doing this effectively, what is our end product for the brands that we're working with? It is higher conversion rates. On average, our customers increase their conversion rate by 50%. Our better success cases are over 200% growth in conversion rate and lower conversion costs. The most recent aspect that we added on was the actual AI sales agents component. In the past, we actually would direct those leads into our customers' call centers or into their chat, you know, human chat teams. Now we've added AI sales agents on top that basically connects into our customers, into a knowledge base that we build from our customers on their products and how to sell. We connect and integrate into our customers' systems for credit check, into their systems for product availability, pricing, documentation, and contract finalization, so that our AI sales agents can actually drive that conversion 100% via chat. In Brazil, this actually ends up being mostly via WhatsApp, which is the primary chat platform leveraged by consumers just to talk day-to-day in the market. And now it's been greatly adopted by brands. And the way that we charge, the business model specifically, is our value prop for brands is increasing their conversion rates, getting them incremental customers. And that's how we get paid. We get paid for actually driving incremental sales for our brand partners. We implement the technology and we measure every transaction that gets processed through the platform, and we get a percentage of each transaction. And where we really start making money is when that becomes incremental sales for the partners.
Now, you guys have raised about $50 million. I mean, you have 400 employees, which is really remarkable. How has it been to the journey of raising this money, you know, in a country like Brazil?
Yeah, well, I mean, in those early days, you know, we didn't raise money initially when we started the business. You know, it was first completely bootstrapped, and you know, the office was in my apartment back then, and we had clients, but it took us almost, I don't know, 6 months or more to actually open up a bank account. The process was so complex by then, and I remember, you know, I would take the metro every day or every other day to Avenida Paulista, where there was one ATM machine that would work with my debit card, and I would do the maximum withdrawal from my debit card from the ATM and come back, because at that point we probably had about 15 people working for us full time out of the apartment. I'd come back and I would pay people in cash, you know, whatever it was, 1/20th of their salary. And then the next day I would go back to the ATM, withdraw the maximum amount, and give people the next 1/20th of their salary. Eventually, you know, we actually got kicked out of my apartment as an office. The building did not let us stick around there in the residence. So we had to go figure out what our new place would be. And we ended up getting our new office above a little pizza restaurant in São Paulo. And yeah, we grew the business. You know, eventually we were able to open up the bank account and start getting paid by customers, and grew the business initially cash, you know, with its own cash flows. But then we saw this bigger vision to build out this conversion platform that would require more serious product investment and a much bigger opportunity. We closed our first customer on this, a big telco in Brazil. And once we did that, we then raised our first institutional round of capital. Back then, there weren't many options in Brazil. I think there were maybe only two investment funds back then who were investing in tech, software businesses, early stage with, you know, standard VC type terms. And we were lucky enough that one of them chose to invest in us. They led that first seed round, and we had a handful of angel investors join along in that journey. They joined too. We raised about $1.1 million in that first round. That gave us enough capital to go build out the platform, go launch this first customer. We grew their sales dramatically. We became their biggest sales channel, actually. And then we closed an additional telco partner and raised additional capital for that. And so we then raised capital from Global Founders Capital. Our first investor who led that round was Red Point eVentures. The second round was Red Point followed along in that round. Continued scaling, we then branched off into additional sectors. Our platform is very built out in a handful of sectors that has a lot of system integrations with and data integrations with. And so we expanded from telco into health insurance and into banking. When we did that first expansion to health insurance, we closed a round with Kazakh, which were the original builders of Mercado Libre and incredible operators and partners for the business. We closed about $7 million with them in our Series A round. We then went into the banking space and closed some partnerships with some large Brazilian banks, helping them to convert on products like auto finance loans, collateralized loans, account opening, credit card, home equity, and others. And when we did that, we then closed our most recent round, which was with QED and with QED's some fintech investors who have a lot of experience in that was really relevant to our expansion to the banking space, and also knew our business model very well. And Invis is a family office out of New York, evergreen investment fund. We always wanted to go build a long-term company. We never wanted to build something to sell, something we would one day perhaps sell, but a company that whenever we have the option to sell, we would always want to go double down on and keep taking to the next level. And they were great investors who fit with our vision, strong evergreen fund and really long-term thinkers, and brought a really good private equity perspective to the table too. So that's kind of the major history of the rounds.
So in your case, eventually you came back and now you're in North Carolina to basically be with family, be closer. I mean, obviously Brazil is quite a trip. So you came back in. And you took the executive chairman, you know, role there. Now, in your case, you know, you ended up, the company, you know, hasn't sold, but you did a partial exit. And I think that this would be interesting for the founders that are listening, you know, to be able to understand how typically these structures would work. But in your case, you ended up doing a partial exit via secondary. So how does that typically work? And what can you share, you know, with the founders listening on maybe how they should think about that or go about it?
Sure. I don't know if I can speak to how it generally works, but I can speak to my experience and how it worked. For us, it was actually pretty organic as part of our fundraising rounds. We were lucky enough to be oversubscribed in our rounds. We were pretty cash efficient, didn't need to take on much capital, and we had multiple investors wanting to participate in the company. And it just seemed like a appropriate opportunity for us, you know, as entrepreneurs, you know, you have so much concentration in one business, which is amazing and great. It keeps you completely focused and with total drive. But at the same time, you know, it's definitely is, you know, a little nerve-wracking on that crazy roller coaster of entrepreneurship. You know, I talked about a lot of the high moments and successes of raising rounds and getting new clients and expansion, but there's definitely dark, challenging moments in that journey too. And when all your wealth is tied up in one single asset, that's a little scary at times. So for us, when we're raising these rounds with investors, it was our last couple of rounds. Basically, we talked to investors about the idea about buying out a portion of my co-founder's shares as we were to get them the equity participation they wanted into the company, and also take a few chips off the table to help us sleep better at night. It was enough for us to help us sleep a lot better, but not so much that, you know, we were not completely vested in the business. You know, still 95% of our net worth and is focused on the company. But it was a nice breath of fresh air and relief for us. And for our funds, it was small enough that they didn't worry about, you know, misaligned interests or anything like that, but relevant enough for us to sleep better and honestly probably make better decisions for the company, because we could focus more on building the biggest company we could with the greatest value and worry a little bit less about risk mitigation.
So then in this case, you know, for you, I mean, you're a climber and you've climbed El Capitan, which is, you know, obviously we've all seen the documentary of Free Solo and, you know, incredible without the ropes. But climbing a mountain to a certain degree is just being a founder, because it's just like the hardships and the uncertainty. I think that you kind of like experience that too. So I guess from climbing mountains, from maybe climbing El Capitan, where you're like 5 days climbing, sleeping, you know, in vertical mode, what kind of lessons, you know, have you taken or you find similar to entrepreneurship when it comes to, let's say, leadership, or when it comes to, you know, maybe like business?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Escali, the company, actually, you know, it's the infinitive, although it means scale in Portuguese, is the infinitive of scale. It's also the infinitive of climb. And it was always a very large metaphor for us in the company. And that's because my business partner, co-founder, Ken, and Daniel, the other co-founder, I've just got him to agree to go on a adventure with me soon up a cliff. But Ken, when he first arrived in Brazil, we traveled around a bunch and I took him on some pretty wild climbs together. I mean, they were things, and now that I look back, you know, he was definitely not at all prepared for the experiences, but it was actually incredible what we did as a team together. We climbed some really big faces, 1,000-foot faces in Brazil, took him on some amazing adventures. And honestly, it was an amazing test of our partnership together. To go through real hardship together, scary experiences, looking down at 600 feet below you, and have trust in one another, have really strong communication, be able to interact in really stressful environments well, to plan together the logistics around it. Honestly, it was an amazing way for us to go test our partnership before launching the business. When I climbed El Cap, that was with Ryan Williamson, one of my best climbing partners. We've done a few routes in Yosemite. On the El Cap one, we ended up sleeping for 4 or 5 nights on this vertical face as we got to the top. And yeah, I mean, when I think about the experiences that we had together, or with other folks, friends of mine, Ted Hester, we climbed some stuff in Patagonia together. And I think through those experiences and those partnerships that I had with people, I think there's so many lessons around partnership, honestly, you know, and the partnership, not just the physical element of the partnership, there, that is one component of it. When you're going after a route, often it's good to have people with complementary skill sets who can lead different sections of the route based off what they're strongest at. If they're stronger at ice climbing, or stronger at free climbing with their hands, or stronger at aid climbing, put a little equipment in the rock to be able to pull on. But also, not just the physical component of that partnership, but also just the emotional component of that partnership, to be able to support each other, energize each other, to be able to look at an objective that honestly seems almost impossible and absurd initially, but to be able to train together for that. And then when you're going on that objective, to then take it step by step. You know, it's you know, when you look at that mountain from far away, it seems impossible. And at the end, it's really just one step at a time to go in that journey. And I think you learn there's failures. Like, you don't always go hit the summit. You know, sometimes you got to make good decisions to come back. But you can figure out, you know, generally there are many times where we didn't hit the summit the first time, but we would replan, re-strategize, come back the next day or the next week or the next year, more learned, more prepared, more trained, and go after and then have success reaching the objective. And so I think there's a lot of these parallels that connect to business and the adaptation, needing to prepare, learn, and also to have honestly like ridiculous confidence in your ability, not necessarily to execute perfectly, but to be able to have the skills enough to improv along the way, figure it out, shift plans, and then be able to execute the mission. So yeah, there's a lot of interesting parallels that and learnings. Maybe one last one I would share is also on risk mitigation and being able to execute really well under extreme stress. You know, in climbing, there's many times where you are physically pushing at your limit and you need to, you know, put in little metal pieces into the rock to anchor you in. And you have to be thinking really sharply at those moments. And you need to be able to both execute physically at your highest level while mentally staying really sharp, and to be able to block out the fear, of course, to be aware of the danger, but to block out the fear element that impacts your mental and physical capabilities. And honestly, entrepreneurship is very similar. There's dangers all the time. You need to execute really well and sharply and not let the fear impact you.
So once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. So obviously now that you have a little more time, what can we expect from Matthew as the next chapter?
Yeah, you know, after moving to exec chairman, I took a sabbatical with my wife, traveled around, had a blast. But it was funny, you know, I always kind of looked at that sabbatical as you know, to travel around the world and rock climb as, you know, the goal, you know, of where to go get to after the day-to-day of the company. But within a month of that, I realized that is not fulfilling for me. As amazing as it was and fun, I just love building things. I like creating value in the world and for others. And I was excited to go back into it. I spent a little bit of time over this past year helping other friends of mine building businesses, a climate tech fund launch in the US, growth stage fund expand in the US market, or another growth stage professional services company expand. But I've now actually gotten some clarity on something I'm excited to go build into the US market. And it actually leverages a lot of what I felt from the experience in Brazil. When I went to Brazil, like I mentioned initially, I felt like I had this crystal ball from the US and saw the world 5 to 10 years ahead of Brazil and could bring the best practices of conversion into the Brazilian market. And now I feel like it's the other way around. As I come back to the US from Brazil, Brazil has actually leapfrogged the US in technology in many ways. And one of those ways is the way that brands interact with customers and around being able to engage with the customers via WhatsApp. That's one of the ways that's just so much easier in Brazil versus the US. I'm really excited to go build a business in the US to enable US brands now to engage with customers via chat with Gen AI agents throughout the entire vertical of what they need for customers, from not just the conversion side, but from the ongoing customer support and the ongoing re-engagement of that customer, the ongoing fidelity of that customer. I'm looking at a particular vertical to go build that into. And it's in the very early discovery stages, but excited to be diving into this.
So, Matthew, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
My LinkedIn is good, Matthew Kligerman. Gmail is there, matthew.kligerman@gmail.com. Either one.
Amazing. Well, hey, well, easy enough. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Alejandro. It's great to be here with you too.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.